From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, screenwriter and actor Mike White. He wrote the new film The Good Girl, starring Jennifer Aniston. He also wrote and starred in the independent film Chuck and Buck and wrote for the TV shows Dawson's Creek and Freaks and Geeks. Also, we talk with actress Cynthia Nixon. She plays Miranda on Sex and the City. Miranda's life has been radically changed now that she's the single mother of a newborn baby. Actress Cynthia Nixon is pregnant with her second child. And book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews The Artificial Silk Girl, a 1932 German novel, newly translated, about a sexually liberated young woman who wants to be an actress. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The president toured the nation's largest wildfire today in southern Oregon. Mr. Bush announced a new policy aimed at easing restrictions on tree cutting in fire-prone forests. Robert Smith reports from Medford, Oregon.
Speaking to a crowd that included forest managers, ranchers, and firefighters, President Bush said it's the government's job to prevent fires, like the one that's burned almost 500,000 acres outside of this town. The president announced that the administration's new policy will be to thin out more of the dry underbrush and trees that contribute to massive fires. His plan indicates that this will mean more contracts with private companies that can keep the wood they take out of the forest, and the streamlining of environmental regulations so that these deals could be made more quickly and without lengthy appeals. Outside the speech, environmental groups warned that relaxing environmental protections could open the forest up to more extreme cutting. They're asking the federal government to focus its firefighting efforts on the areas around homes and communities and leave the backcountry of the national forests alone. Robert Smith, NPR News, Medford, Oregon.
The State Department expressed concern today over President Pervez Musharraf's constitutional changes in Pakistan. Spokesman Philip Reeker said the U.S. is concerned that Musharraf's changes could make it more difficult for Pakistan to build strong democratic institutions. Musharraf announced yesterday that he was going ahead with constitutional amendments that would increase his power and extend his current term in office by another 5 years. Reeker said the issue will be part of the discussions when Deputy Secretary of State Richard Armitage arrives in Islamabad for talks with Musharraf on Saturday. South Africa, Botswana, and Mozambique deny that they're working with the United States to isolate Zimbabwe's President Robert Mugabe. A senior U.S. official said this week that the U.S. was working with Zimbabwe's neighbors to effect political change in the country. NPR's Vicky O'Hara reports.
As the U.S. announced new food aid for drought-stricken southern Africa, U.S. officials blasted President Mugabe, saying his policies are exacerbating food shortages throughout the region. Assistant Secretary of State for Africa Walter Kansteiner challenged Mugabe's government, saying he was elected through fraud. Kansteiner said the U.S. would help Zimbabweans correct the situation with assistance from neighboring states. When asked about the denials from neighboring governments, State Department spokesman Philip Reeker said the U.S. maintains active diplomatic consultations to emphasize Washington's low opinion of Mugabe. The U.S. especially criticizes Mugabe's policy of seizing white-owned farms and redistributing them to blacks. U.S. officials say the farms have stopped producing. Vicky O'Hara, NPR News, Washington.
In stocks today, the Dow Industrials gained 96 points, or 1%, to close at 9,053. The NASDAQ Composite Index gained 13 points, or nearly 1%, to close at 1,422. This is NPR News. Consumer advocates say ratepayers will be hurt by a deal reached between the State Public Utilities Commission in California and the creditors of the bankrupt Pacific Gas and Electric Company. Authorities for the commission said the agreement will allow PG&E to settle its debts and resume buying electricity for its customers. Power for the utility customers is currently bought by the state of California. Consumer groups said they'll sue to prevent the plan from taking effect. They say the plan is a bailout that'll force utility customers to keep paying record high rates for years to come. In France, a suspected Basque terrorist has escaped jail by switching places with his brother. They made the swap during a prison visit over the weekend. NPR's Nick Spicer reports from Paris.
The terror suspect was arrested this summer with 130 pounds of explosives, bomb-making manuals, and loaded guns. Police suspect Ismael Berasategui Escudero belongs to the Basque separatist movement ETA. It has claimed responsibility for 800 deaths in 3 decades of fighting for independence from Spain. Escudero was being held at the high-security Santé prison in Paris. At least officials thought he was. They realized today his brother had taken his place over the weekend during a visit. The warden explained that they looked alike. The prison uses a system of invisible ink on prisoners' hands to prevent such escapes, but it clearly failed. The brother now faces charges of helping a prisoner escape. Nick Spicer, NPR News, Paris.
Heavy rain struck parts of the Midwest today, briefly flooding 2 key expressways in the Chicago area during the morning rush hour. Rainstorms hampered takeoffs and landings at Chicago's O'Hare Airport, causing delays of up to an hour and a half. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Annie E. Casey Foundation, helping disadvantaged children and their families connect to strong and supportive neighborhoods, on the web at aecf.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Mike White, wrote the new film, The Good Girl. He also wrote and starred in the film Chuck and Buck, wrote the screenplay for the recent comedy Orange County, and wrote for the TV series Dawson's Creek and Freaks and Geeks. In his new movie, The Good Girl, Jennifer Aniston plays Justine, a 30-something woman in a small Texas town who feels trapped by her life but sees no way out. She hates her job at the local discount store, Retail Rodeo, and her husband seems to always be stoned on marijuana when she gets home from work. But a new employee at the Retail Rodeo catches her attention. He's young and brooding. He calls himself Holden, after the main character in the novel The Catcher in the Rye. Holden, played by Jake Gyllenhaal, is barely out of his teens, still lives at home with his parents, and feels trapped by his life, too. He takes refuge in writing stories about his unhappy life. In this scene, Justine gives him a ride home after work. He invites her in, they walk past his parents, who are watching TV in the living room, and have this conversation in his bedroom.
This is my room.
Not a lot to look at. What are your folks like?
They're okay. They don't get me. I mean, they're all right. I just...
My husband doesn't get me.
Since when do you have a husband?
Since 7 years. He's a painter.
What's he paint?
Houses. He's a pig. He talks, but he doesn't think. I'm sick of it. I was looking at you in the store, and I liked how you kept to yourself. I saw in your eyes that you hate the world. I hate it, too. You know what I'm talking about?
Mike White, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thanks.
Now, the Jennifer Aniston character says to her younger boyfriend, played by Jake Gyllenhaal, "I saw in your eyes that you hate the world. I hate it, too." But that shared hatred really isn't enough to form a lasting bond. Did you ever think that it was, that a shared kind of alienation was was a really strong bond?
Well, it's interesting that you talk about that, because it really was the idea that sort of inspired the movie, which is, you know, sometimes we see in other people our own, you know, it's like out of, yeah, a shared hatred, you can't create a love, you know. And I think that, you know, sometimes, you know, when you are in pain or, you know, depressed, you know, you look to someone else who feels the way you're feeling, and yet sometimes that just adds to the misery.
The Jennifer Aniston character, who thinks of herself as really trapped by her life, calls her husband a pig and a pothead, but in his own way, he's a very sympathetic character with a big heart. He's played by John C. Reilly, who also starred in Boogie Nights, Hard Eight, Magnolia, and The Perfect Storm. Can you tell us why you wanted to cast him? I think he's terrific.
Well, that character's really important. I mean, all of the characters. I mean, the idea for me, one of the big themes of the movie is about change and the ability, you know, do we have the ability to change ourselves? And I wanted all of the characters to sort of, just like, you know, she's giving makeovers to the women in the store, you kind of want to just feel like through the narrative, all of the characters go through some kind of makeover, whether it's through their, you know, they change or the perception of them changes through the course of the movie. And his character was key because of the way things transpire, and you want to feel like at the beginning he's this one type of character and that he's, you know, he has nothing to offer her, and you understand why she feels so, you know, desperate in this relationship. But it was important that over the course of the movie you realize that he, you know, he is got a big heart, and that there is something more to him than what you see at the beginning, and that in the end it almost feels like that's the love story.
Now, in The Good Girl, you play a security guard at the retail rodeo, the discount store. Let me play a clip from the movie. In this scene, you invite the Jennifer Aniston character to a Bible study meeting.
Hey, Justine. Can I talk to you for a second?
Yeah.
I was just curious, have you ever been to a Bible study?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, we got a good one going on every Wednesday at the First Church of Nazarene. Rodney comes, Benita comes. You got any interest in reading the Bible?
I have my own, you know, beliefs.
Well, we don't preach fire and brimstone. 10 Commandments, gotta live by those. Other than the usual ways, we're not interested in scaring people. We're about loving Jesus.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I kind of like my nights to myself.
Well, maybe you'll have night after night of eternal hellfire all to yourself. Just kidding you. Drive safe.
That was Mike White and Jennifer Aniston in a scene from The Good Girl. Mike White not only co-stars in the movie, he wrote it. Mike, you must know a lot about Bible study. Your father, Mel White, is a minister who ghostwrote biographies for Jerry Falwell, Pat Robertson, and I think Billy Graham. But then your father came out, and his co-authors didn't exactly approve of his being gay. Well, how old were you when that happened?
I was around 11 years old when I found out what was going on with my family, and then it just kind of, the whole process of his coming out was like very extended, so it went on for, you know, throughout my high school years.
What did it look like from your point of view as not even a young man yet? I mean, you're a preteener, as they say. Mm-hmm. To have your father surprise the family and the world with his sexual orientation. I don't know, it's a very young age to be thinking a lot about that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, it was definitely a life-altering experience. And the fact that he was gay was less of a difficult thing to digest than just, you know, the fact of my parents' marriage unraveling and our family transforming. It was, for, you know, many years when I was growing up, I felt like we had the picture perfect family, and you know, to have that sort of illusion pulled out from under you, you know, changes the way you see things.
Your father stayed religious. He's the minister now in a gay church. But were you expected to change your religious perspective when he came out? I figure you grew up a lot in the church, and mm-hmm. I presume it was a fundamentalist church.
Right. I think my father was very sensitive to the fact that when he grew up, there was really a lot of proselytizing within the household, and this sense of, you know, are you okay with the Lord every day, you know, with his own parents. And he was really sensitive to not kind of foist his beliefs upon me, you know, and was sensitive from an early age. So it was, I do have a sort of complicated, I don't know, relationship to organized religion, but I never, you know, I was never a sort of a devout believer, you know, from the time I was a little kid. I just had a sort of skeptical perspective on it all, so.
Were there things that you were expected to do or expected to avoid as a Christian kid?
Yeah, I mean, there was this sense of, you know, you don't curse, you don't, you know, I was kind of a precocious kid, and I was a real movie fan even early on, and always, you know, was demanding that my parents would take me across town to see these sort of, you know, to these art house movies, you know, and for some reason, I, you know, at the time, I really, you know, I would pitch a fit if they wouldn't take me, and a lot of times the content of the movies were completely inappropriate for someone my age, but I was willful, and my parents kind of didn't know what to do. So there was those kinds of issues all the time, and yet my parents, you know, in that world were actually pretty liberal comparatively.
What was one of the movies that you insisted on seeing that, if they could have, they would have prevented you from seeing?
Well, they ended up taking me, but I remember I wanted to see that movie. I must have been 8 years old, and I wanted to see Woody Allen's Interiors.
Mm-hmm.
Wanted to see it again and again. I don't know. I just felt like at the time I was like, oh, this is what profundity looks like.
It's a lot of Sturm und Drang for a young kid.
Yeah. But so I was always in search of. I mean, I had my second grade teacher was Sam Shepard's mother.
No kidding.
Yeah, she was a teacher at my elementary school, and she was a great teacher and was my favorite. And so I think it was around when I was seven that I realized that, you know, playwriting or whatever could be a career choice. And I was reading Buried Child in second grade and thinking, this is what I want to do.
Right?
Yeah, exactly. This is what I want to do. So I was kind of a weird kid, as you can imagine.
Were you writing pretentious theater as a kid?
Yes. The more pretentious, the better. I mean, I feel like, you know, sometimes I look at what I've done now and I think, gosh, all my like heady, highbrow stuff I wrote 10, 15 years ago. But I don't know. Now I'm sort of more, I don't know, like wary to go down the road of pretense.
Now, some of the people who you knew as a child, who your father worked with before he came out, were people like Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson. And these are people who see Hollywood as kind of like the gates to hell.
Mm-hmm.
Did any of that ever rub off on you? And I guess, you know, there you are in the center of it now.
Yeah. Well, I remember when I was a kid growing up, my grandparents, my father's parents, were very, very devout and conservative Christians. And I remember, you know, I was such a movie enthusiast. I remember, you know, I used to watch The China Syndrome, this movie with Jane Fonda, and mm-hmm. I was really into it. And when my grandparents came to town, I was like, oh, you have to see this movie. It's, you know, about, you know, nuclear, you know, energy and all of the, you know, dangers of it. And I put it on, and my grandmother sat down, and she just she put a little mark on a piece of paper for every time someone cussed, and her response to the movie was, well, there were 40, you know, GDs and, you know, 30 four-letter words, and how could you be watching this? And at the time, I you know, in my head, I was like, well, this sort of seals the deal. It's like, you know, if I have to choose between sort of my father's, like, religious heritage or, you know, the world of movies, I definitely know where I come down, and kind of, you know, early on was saying, if there's two churches and one is the church of the movie theater and the church of organized religion, I guess I belong to the church of movies.
Do you still go to church?
I do. I, you know, for me, every time I go to church, it's like an insanely emotional experience. I just start crying the minute I go in and cry until I leave. I find the ritual so moving, and it just brings back a lot of childhood memories. It's such a powerful experience. And I do think what I aspire to do in terms of my writing and in terms of the movie going experience is trying to create something that is, you know, that verges on the feelings that a good church going experience provides, you know, something that's cathartic and has a spiritual component and is powerful in terms of the way you think about your life and what you've done and the choices you've made and an introspective experience. And so, you know, there's a little bit of sermonizing in the stuff that I do, although I'm also loath to do it in an overt way.
My guest is Mike White. He wrote the new film, The Good Girl. We'll talk more after our break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Mike White. He's a screenwriter and actor. He wrote and starred in the independent film Chuck and Buck. He wrote and has a small part in the new film, The Good Girl, which stars Jennifer Aniston. And he also co-wrote the movie Orange County. Let's talk about your first film, Chuck and Buck. I'm going to ask you to describe the two main characters in the story.
Well, there's the character I played was Buck, who is sort of the image of stunted maturity, who's, you know, he seems like a sort of 12-year-old in a man's body who loses his mother at the beginning of the movie and tracks down his old childhood friend, Chuck, who was played by Chris Weitz, and who's now a sort of Hollywood mover and shaker and has really forgotten about his old friend until he shows up in his life.
And when Buck shows up at Chuck's door, he nearly becomes Chuck's stalker. And Chuck really wants nothing to do with Buck anymore. And Buck can't really comprehend that Chuck has really grown up and that Chuck has an important job, that Chuck signs rock bands and produces things. Your character is actually kind of creepy because he's never emotionally developed past childhood. Also, he's gay, but he has a child's understanding of how to deal with sexuality, which is you play sex games, secret sex games with your friend. And he's become almost like a stalker to his old childhood friend, Chuck. How does this character look from your point of view, his creator and the actor who played him?
Well, I think everything you said is apt. I think that, you know, for me, I like the character in the sense that he, in a very twisted way, represents something kind of pure and something that's uncompromised. and yet at the same time, he is stunted. And so, you know, I was trying to, in creating the character, say something about childhood and sexuality and how, in a way, it's much more complex and vibrant then than, you know, it is as an adult, where you where in a way this some of the compromises or the simplifications of it are in some ways seemingly untrue or inauthentic. It's certainly in the case of the other character, Chuck. You wonder what really, you know, how much of his sexuality or his even his entire personality is inauthentic.
In your movie Chuck and Buck, Buck is such a loser. I mean, he really is not cognizant of what's happening in the world around him. He's emotionally stunted in his childhood. He has no friends. And yet you have a happy ending. In the movie, things kind of work out in part through his discovery of writing plays and the context that he makes through that. It seems improbable that such a story would have a happy ending.
Well, I don't know. To me, you know, I feel like that character needs a happy ending. Otherwise, the movie, I think, is just, you know, too unrelentingly bleak. I mean, I feel like he... you know, the hope is that, you know, if you look at the movie from a sort of a, I don't know, a Jungian psychological place, it's, you know, they are two sides of the same person. And in a way, you know, what you're seeking is a kind of an ending where both can coexist and neither has to die in some way. And I feel like that was what I was aiming for.
Why did you want to play the character of Buck?
Well, I actually didn't write it to play it. I don't know. It was Miguel Arteta's idea, the director, and for me, it just seemed like an exciting opportunity to get out of the cave that was my writing life. It seemed like an opportunity too challenging and terrifying to not pursue. So I did it, for better or worse.
What was it like in that first movie to see yourself blown up on screen?
It was horrifying. The first time I saw it with an audience was at Sundance, and my father was there. And I just remember there's one scene where Buck is telling a little kid, you know, the kid says he can't have lollipops because it'll rot your teeth. And I'm saying, and my character says, oh, you know, I eat them all the time, and look at my teeth. And I open my mouth, and they're completely corroded and cruddy. Yeah. And my father looked at me, and he was like, what are you doing? Like, why are you showing this strange, you know, in a way people could say it was an alter ego or something. You know, why are you showing this, you know, face to the world? And, you know, it was such a strange, I don't know, psychodrama going on inside my head to see that all come to life.
Are those gray corroding teeth really yours?
No.
Oh, okay. So you were just acting. I mean, I was just acting.
No.
It's not like you were letting us in on a cosmetic secret.
No, but I think that, I mean, it's a more just a metaphor for, you know, a lot of times, especially when you go public, you want to show your best face, put your best face forward. And the creation of Buck was definitely trying to show a character that you wouldn't want to be, you know, somebody that, you know, is in some ways who has nothing to offer and is, you know, extremely dysfunctional and is the person you don't want to be. And so it's even interesting now as, you know, years have gone by since, you know, I played the part, how, you know, people confuse me with the character and how I'm living with that to this day.
What's next for you?
I have written a script that starts shooting in November called The School of Rock. It's for Scott Rudin and Paramount, and Jack Black is going to star in it.
What's it about?
It's about Jack Black plays a musician who can't find anyone to be in his band because he has such a bad reputation, so he ends up pretending to be a substitute teacher for a fourth grade class filled with musical prodigies and uses them to be his backup band.
Wow.
It's going to be a sort of a complicated endeavor, but it's definitely a lark.
Okay. Well, good luck with your movies.
Thanks so much.
And thanks so much for talking with us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Mike White wrote the screenplay for the new film The Good Girl and plays the part of the security guard Corny. He wrote and starred in the film Chuck and Buck. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And by Bantam Books, a division of Random House, publisher of A Great Deliverance by Elizabeth George, an Inspector Lindley novel and companion edition to the mystery presentation on public television. This is NPR, National Public Radio. On Sex and the City, Miranda has just become the single mother of a newborn baby, and it's turning her life upside down. Coming up, we meet the actress who plays Miranda, Cynthia Nixon. She's pregnant with her second child. And Maureen Carrigan reviews a new translation of a German novel first published in 1932 about a sexually liberated young woman. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Life has completely changed for the character of Miranda on HBO's Sex and the City. Last season ended with the birth of her baby. This season, she's adjusting to being the single mother of an infant and trying to figure out how much she can keep of her old social life.
I can't go. I'm just not ready to be separated from the baby.
What?
I'm kidding! Steve took him 2 hours ago. I'm free! I'm free! I'm leaving the compound!
While Miranda figures out her new life, the actress who plays her, my guest Cynthia Nixon, is pregnant with her second child. Nixon is nominated for an Emmy for her portrayal of Miranda. She started acting professionally in her early teens. Until Sex and the City, she was best known for her theater work. Her character on Sex and the City is trying to keep up her law career and social life by hiring a nanny for the baby and sharing some of the parenting with her former boyfriend, who's the baby's father. In this scene, she's ready to go with her friend Carrie for a weekend in Atlantic City after leaving the baby with his father. But just as she's ready to leave, he shows up at the door with the baby.
Hi, how you doing?
Steve, what's wrong? What are you doing back here?
Oh, I thought I forgot the wipes. But it turns out, actually, I don't think I can do this.
Excuse me?
I'm afraid that I might break him or something. Look, I accidentally scratched his face with my dirty fingernail. Look.
It's nothing. You've taken care of him before. It's been fine.
But for 2 hours. Yeah, for 2 hours, I'm great. But, you know, after 2 hours, I might accidentally kill him.
Look, we're both afraid we're going to kill the baby. That's a given. But we made an agreement this week. Monday to Friday, I try not to kill him. Saturday and Sunday, you try not to kill him.
Cynthia Nixon, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much.
Now, your character, Miranda, has just become a single mother.
Yes.
In real life.
Somewhat. Yes, go ahead.
In real life, you're pregnant for the second time.
I am.
Yes. What is Miranda most unprepared for about motherhood?
I think Miranda is not prepared for the way for Miranda is a control freak, and Miranda is a high-powered lawyer, and she is used to scheduling everything, and she is used to barking and having people jump, and she is used to, you know, dividing up her life, and she's, you know, a multitasker and efficiency expert, and I think she's not so good at, you know, with people all the time, and she's not so good at sort of going moment to moment. So I think the baby overwhelms her. I think in that scene that we just heard, it's a perfect example of she's trying to schedule it. She's felt like she's put in her hours with the baby, and now she's deserves this payback. She deserves this time off. And it doesn't always work that way. The human element can wreak havoc with your schedule.
Miranda and Steve, they're both seem to be afraid that they're going to accidentally kill the baby. Was that an anxiety of yours when you first became a mother?
No. Miranda and Steve seem to have a fair amount of new parent anxiety, which I personally, perhaps I'm callous or unfeeling. I was never particularly worried. I was not, when I was going to become a mother for the first time, I wasn't that worried about it, you know? I mean, I was a little worried about the labor, you know, the scariness and the pain and that kind of thing. But, you know, I didn't have much experience with children or babies, but it didn't worry me too much, I gotta say.
So how pregnant are you now?
I'm about 5 months.
The number of episodes of this season's worth of Sex and the City was shortened because of Sarah Jessica Parker's pregnancy.
Right.
Would yours have affected the shoots, too? I mean, how pregnant were you when you were shooting this season?
No, they would not have affected this season's. Let's see. We finished filming about 2 weeks ago, so I was about 4.5 months when they finished, and Sarah was about 6 months when they finished. So, no, it wouldn't have been an issue. And I got to say, I think that the wardrobe people and the prop people putting objects in front of her, you know, did a really great job and in disguising her pregnancy, you know, which was a little farther along than mine.
Well, my impression is that this season, all the women on Sex and the City are wearing different clothes than they used to be wearing. Trench coats, baggy sweaters.
Yeah, you think so?
Yeah.
Well, I know Miranda. I mean, Miranda, I would say Miranda is, but she's the only one that I would say that of, because Miranda definitely She's got a lot of things going on. She's got a lot of weight that she hasn't lost, post-pregnancy weight, which becomes an issue, you know, when she goes to Weight Watchers and, you know, decides to try and get back to where she used to be before she was pregnant. And I think, frankly, also Miranda does go through a little, you know, when you have a new baby, it kind of hits you hard. And, you know, these women spend an awful lot of time getting dressed and putting on their makeup and having their hair done. And Miranda, I think, in what I think is a kind of a realistic touch for us, you know, Miranda stops paying so much attention to that, and she kind of wears schlumpy clothes for a while because, you know, she's not sleeping. If she's not sleeping, she's probably not getting her hair cut and, you know, doing her beautiful makeup and putting together ensembles.
Miranda's body weight when she was pregnant and her body weight now after pregnancy has been a big issue on the show, just how she was physically transformed and the discomfort and self-consciousness that it caused her. It sounds like that has not been an issue for you.
That has not been an issue for me, no. No, I never really moved in this world that Miranda moves in. You know, Miranda is the least of the four of them, maybe, but she's still kind of very interested in the clothes and very interested in the way she presents herself and kind of out in the dating world and so aware of how she looks and how she looks to men. And, you know, I've been out of the dating scene for, like, you know, 14 years, so not since I was, like, 21 or 22. So I, yes, was not such an issue for me.
Is there anything you envy about the single life as it's portrayed on Sex and the City?
The only thing that I would say that I would envy is, and all four of the actresses talk about this, is the amount of time these women are able to spend with each other.
Isn't it remarkable?
It's remarkable. In the same way people complain sometimes about how do these women find so many eligible, appealing men to date in this city. We may be stretching the truth a little bit. I think we're also stretching the truth in terms of even though the four of them are so close, I mean, these people see each other two or even three times a week. I mean, I have, you know, women in my life that I am certainly as close to as the four of these. But, you know, I'm lucky to see them once every couple weeks. I envy them their coffee shop time. Mm-hmm. That kind of time in which you can just loll about on a Saturday morning and catch up. Particularly, I would say, since I've had my daughter, you know, that kind of endless unscheduled time is not to be found plentifully in my life.
Cynthia Nixon is my guest. She plays Miranda on Sex and the City. You're pregnant now with your second child, and you're not married to your partner. You both decided not to get married. What's behind? You've talked about it before, so I don't feel uncomfortable asking you about
right.
this. But
No.
But what are some of the reasons why you think marriage is not necessary for you?
Well, let's see. We've been together since we were 21, and we've known each other a lot longer than that. We've known each other since we were 12 or 13, because we went to junior high and high school and college together. So we've known each other a long time. I would say that in the first few months very soon in our relationship, I was going to say the first few weeks, but that's perhaps an exaggeration. In the first few months that we were together, we knew that we were going to be together, you know, forever or, you know, whatever. We were together. There was no question. So, and I got to say, we're both fairly serious people. We're both fairly devoted people. There's a lot of things that make me wary about marriage, but I also have got to say, I've always felt so confident about Danny and so sure of him that I didn't really feel a need to sort of, you know, nail him down. I thought he's going to be here. You know, he's going to be here because he wants to be here, and I'm going to be here because I want to be here. I had gone out with a guy actually before him for a long time, for about 5 years. And I had been sort of more anxious to marry my boyfriend before that because I felt more unsure about the relationship and I felt more unsure about where it was going to go. that I wasn't going to be able to hold on to him, and I wanted to hold on to him. And but when I got together with Danny, it didn't seem to be an issue. Also, it's not just as easy as that. It's not just as simple as that. I do have misgivings about marriage. Around the time that Danny and I got together, a couple of friends of mine who were married, their marriages were breaking up. And they both said similar kind of things to me, independent of each other, which was that their relationship really changed when they got married and they started to see the man that they were married to as, like, he lost his name, he just became sort of husband. And that they had all these expectations of him now that he was in this archetypal role, and it kind of got in the way of them really seeing him just as a person. And you know, I don't see any reason for it. And I would say our relationship is a fairly private relationship. You know, I have to go out on the town a fair amount. I am, you know, in a public profession, and he is a more private person. So he comes out for the events that he needs to come out for, but, To me, also at that time, marriage was something like a husband was sort of like an accessory that you had with you at the parties. And he's never been that kind of a partner for me. You know, he's not a, he's my private guy. He's my private guy at home.
How do you think your daughter will feel as she gets older, having to tell friends that her parents aren't married to each other, even though they live together? Do you think that'll be an issue for her?
Oh, she tells people no.
Yeah.
She doesn't really like it. She's been asking us about it for years. I mean, she's five. She's almost six. She's been asking us about it for years. But I would say, you know, she has, my daughter is kind of the captain of the gender police. she's very, very, very girly. She gets very pleased with the more girly my clothes are. She used to be displeased with me if I would wear pants, or she used to say, women don't wear belts. I remember that was one of her cries. I got to say, first of all, I think so there are so many people with children and without children who are in long-term relationships and are not married. Now, I would think, unless there's some horrendous backlash that I'm not foreseeing, I think it'll be even more so as she gets older. And, you know, frankly, if it does bother her, I'm not that interested, I gotta say. You know, it's my life and my decision, and I'm happy with it. And I can't imagine she will really be bothered by it when she grows up. But, you know, she can always go ahead and get married, and I would be thrilled to have her married and plan her wedding and all that stuff. But that issue just doesn't resonate with me.
My guest is Cynthia Nixon. She plays Miranda on Sex and the City. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Cynthia Nixon, and she plays Miranda on Sex and the City. Manhattan is one of the stars of the series. You've lived in Manhattan your whole life.
Mm-hmm.
What kept your parents in Manhattan after you were born? A lot of couples who start off in Manhattan leave for the suburbs, or at least for a neighborhood in Brooklyn, after mm-hmm. they have children, because Manhattan is very expensive, for one. There's no backyards.
I don't think my parents ever thought about leaving New York. For sort of separate reasons, probably. My father's dead, but he came from a very small town in Texas. And I think he found it stultifying and dull and very small towny, where your neighbors knew your business and passed judgment on it. I think when he came to New York in the 50s, he found it such an exciting place. He loved it, and I think he thought it was an exciting place not only for adults but for children, which I completely agree with him. My mother grew up in Chicago, and so she always says about herself that she is a total city person, And that, you know, the country or the green, it's nice. It's nice. It's pretty, a little passing diversion. But she always yearns to get back to the city, which seems to her like the real world and like real life, and gets invigorated by it. I too. I mean, you know, you sort of tend toward what you know, I guess, or what you come from. But to me, the city was such a great place to grow up. And such a, for me, when I had my daughter, so, you know, such a, I can't imagine raising children anywhere else, because there's so much here. There's so, like, my vision of hell would be to be, you know, living in a suburban house with a small child or a few small children and being isolated except for my, you know, alone with my kids in my backyard. I feel like the city is the best place to protect them, because so many kids I knew who grew up in the suburbs, you know, once they hit teenagehood, it became so boring for them. There was nothing to do except go to each other's houses and drink. And you're so under your parents' thumb at a time when you just want to be free, free, free. And you're dependent on them to drive you around till you're 16 or whatever, in a very demoralizing way. In New York, once you hit 11 or 12, you're on your own. You're on the subway. You're on the bus. You're your own independent person. And because you've grown up in the city, making your way and dealing with people, you know how to handle yourself. I think it's a great place to grow up.
Did September 11th change your feelings about living in Manhattan?
It changed it. It didn't change it. It made me wonder about it. You know, I was... When September 11th happened, I had just started rehearsal for a play at the Roundabout Theater, and we were rehearsing on 42nd Street in the heart of Times Square. And we took a couple of days off of rehearsal, but then we went right back. And I was of two minds about it, and partly I thought, well, this is my life, and I just have to keep going on with it. I mean, the metaphor that people kept using at that time was, it's like London during the Blitz, and people were brave and they just went on, you know. And then there was another part of me that thought, perhaps I'm totally being foolish here, you know, and perhaps I should be running for the hills and, you know, fleeing to Vermont or Canada or somewhere and hiding out. But I got to say that feeling passed after a month or two, and it really felt like, you know, just sort of wild fear in the end rather than, you know, rationality.
How much do you know about what happens to your character next season?
I know nothing.
Are you curious? Do you ever wonder, like, what's she
gonna
be doing?
Oh, yes. The last few years when we're about to start, we've had meetings, each of us separately, with the writers, and they kind of give us the arc, and they break it down episode by episode, which I, frankly, love. But in terms of next year, I really know nothing.
You love that process of them breaking it down for you?
I love it. I love to get as much information as possible.
What do you love about this process?
Well, first of all, I mean, I just, you know, I'm a fan of Sex and the City the way the viewers are a fan. So, I mean, it's like you want to know what happens. It's like a juicy novel. It's, you know, you want to know what happens to everybody. Cliffhanger, you know. I also just, frankly, I don't know. I always like lots of information. Like I, in a sort of a drudge-like way, I watch all of the dailies, which is the footage that we film. And there's, you know, hours and hours and hours of it. But I really like to scrutinize it and sort of watch my performance and see, you know, particular moments that work or takes that work better or worse, or, you know, of the takes that I like, do they pick the one that I like, or do they pick another take, and why do they pick, you know. So I'm very much a detail-oriented person, so I'm an information gatherer.
Well, Cynthia Nixon, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Cynthia Nixon plays Miranda on Sex and the City. Coming up, book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews a new translation of a 1932 German novel about a sexually liberated young woman. This is Fresh Air. One of the few portraits from a woman's perspective of everyday life in pre-World War II Germany is a 1932 novel called The Artificial Silk Girl by Irmgard Korn. It's just been republished, and book critic Maureen Corrigan says it's sexually frank, funny, and graphic in its depiction of a society on the skids.
In the publishing world, late summer is limbo, the wide Sargasso Sea of seasons. Nothing stirs, all is anticipation. The only faint noise is the heralding wind of the big fall marvels to come. But because August is such a flat month, it's also the time when small press books that often slip under the critical radar get noticed. Such is the case with The Artificial Silk Girl by Irmgard Koyne, a vibrant 1932 novel that's been newly translated from the German by Kathy von Ankom. The Artificial Silk Girl was a sensational bestseller in Germany when it was first published, and no wonder. The novel reads like Bridget Jones's diary, as rewritten by Bertolt Brecht. By 1933, it had been translated and published in England, and banned and burned by the Nazis, who called it an example of asphalt literature with anti-German tendencies. Koyne fled to Belgium and then the Netherlands. When the Nazis occupied those countries, she returned to Germany, where she lived out the war in hiding and continued writing. She died in 1982. The Artificial Silk Girl was a casualty of war until the 1970s, when it was rediscovered by German feminists. The heroine and narrator of The Artificial Silk Girl is named Doris. She's a young woman from the provinces who's besotted by the movies, convinced she has what it takes to become the next Marlene Dietrich. Meanwhile, she works as an office clerk to help support her family. Doris has a strong voice. She's something of a nitwit, but spunky in her stupidity, so you find yourself rooting for her. Doris introduces herself and her chronicle by saying, "I think it will be a good thing if I write everything down, because I am an unusual person. I don't mean a diary. That's ridiculous for a trendy girl like me. But I want to write like a movie, because my life is like that, and it's going to become even more so." Its cinematic style is one of the most striking features of The Artificial Silk Girl. After Doris steals a fur coat and runs away to Berlin to make it as an actress, she generates nonstop verbal snapshots of street life in that city. The corners crowded with prostitutes and World War I veterans selling shoelaces, 10 blonde windbreakers, as Doris calls them, raiding and beating up patrons in a Jewish cabaret, the subway that she refers to as an illuminated coffin on skis, a new fast food joint that sports the American name of Quick, and the bars she visits nightly, filled with scenes like this. Girls were sitting on their bar stools like plucked chickens on a ledge, looking as if they would have to go to a spa first before they would ever be able to lay another egg. And in front of them, guys, like sensual rabbits, sitting up on their hind legs, groveling. Doris herself is a sexually liberated young woman. She's comfortable, even flip, about her desires, and tells us up front that it's never easy for me to say no. Demonstrating the ingenuity of Sex in the City's Samantha, Doris attaches rusty safety pins to her bra and undershirt before one evening out, so that if she winds up drinking too much cognac with the wrong man, in a clinch, she'll be jabbed to her senses. Yet the novel shrewdly dramatizes the catch-22 of a working-class first-generation feminist who can't quite claim her own destiny because she'll never earn enough at the clerical or cleaning jobs she's offered to make it without a man. Here's Doris's cold-eyed assessment of her situation. If a young woman from money marries an old man because of money and nothing else, and makes love to him for hours, and has this pious look on her face, she's called a German mother and decent woman. If a young woman without money sleeps with a man with no money because he has smooth skin and she likes him, she's a whore. For all her cynicism, Doris can't quite give up her Hollywood dreams to snuggle down with one of the sugar daddy industrialists she's always toying with. The artificial silk girl ends with Doris, homeless but still hopeful, wandering the streets of Berlin. She says, "I have buoys of cork in my stomach. They won't let me go down, will they?" It's a poignant question, made all the more so by a contemporary reader's knowledge of the ghastly political realities approaching just beyond the boundary of this last chapter.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed The Artificial Silk Girl by Irmgard Koyne, spelled K-E-U-N. It's published by The Other Press. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Megan Howe, Patty Leswing, and Jessica Chu. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Well, the next Fresh Air, actor Michael C. Hall. He plays the uptight gay funeral director on 6 Feet Under. He's currently starring in the Broadway revival of Chicago. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
I'm Barbara Bogave. Join us for the next Fresh Air.